AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 56 for Thursday, May 20th, 2010. Bob Lutz, biofuels and buyouts. Oh my. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Here we are Thursday night. Welcome, everybody, for AutoLine After Hours. And joining me, as always, the Auto Extremist.
John, good evening.
Good to have you here, Peter.
Glad to be here.
And Business Week Boy is here with us, too, David Welch.
It's Bloomberg Business
Bloomberg
Week.
Bloomberg Business Week. Yeah, he always slips that plug in here.
It's the name of the magazine.
And it's like homecoming. Jason Vines is with us tonight.
It is such a pleasure.
It's a pleasure having you here.
Really?
No, I'm just saying that to be polite.
Hey, I'm getting a lot of great feedback on the show. Ian Beavis, who used to be with Volkswagen, more recently with Kia, told me this is must-see TV.
I'm telling you, man, you'd be surprised how many people in the industry follow this show.
Simon
Spruill told me,
It's on his podcast.
Yeah, he listens to us on his way home from work or on his way to work.
Yeah, because it's like, 1 o'clock in the morning in Paris now or something like that. So
maybe he's up watching us live.
No, he gets the podcast.
That's the only non-socialist broadcast in France. So.
Oh, sorry.
Yet.
Well, we got a lot to get into. I don't know how much we'll get through tonight, but there are no shortage of things to talk about. But, Peter, let's start with your rant this week because big news. Or actually, you have two pieces of news I want to talk about. One was your rant where you were talking about Cadillac and its advertising. But I think the big news that broke afterwards was Campbell Ewald getting some Chevy business back again. Big news in the advertising world.
Well, the bigger news was Publicis, who got a bunch of Chevy business at the end of last year. And was on course to get all of it. Funny thing happened because Joe Iwanek came in and finally got the top job with autonomy and ultimate authority, and he's yanking the Chevrolet business to his buddy and Jeff Goodby. And it's a huge deal. Publicis officially was notified that they had it all, like, in April.
April 23rd.
Yeah, and now they're done.
That was special. 3 weeks.
Yeah. GM came after Joel, and they couldn't make a deal because Joel knew you can't go in there as a CMO and not have complete authority.
And prove that you have it.
And so they, they parted, and then GM came back at him, and this is convincing evidence that Joel has ultimate authority. And he's giving Campbell Ewald, Publicis was going to get all of Chevy, all the retail, and he's putting retail back at Campbell Ewald, which is smart. I mean, they've got the infrastructure. There's no get up to speed. It's all there. So it's very interesting. And if I was the Cadillac agency, I'd be very nervous right now.
Because you think Iwanek will pull it from them.
Well, I mean,
or get rid of the tagline they came up with.
Well, yeah, the tagline is not going to make it.
The mark of leadership.
Yeah, mark of leadership is not going to make it. And, it's interesting times indeed.
I think all of GM's agencies have to be on red alert at this point. They've got McCann doing corporate work, although McCann wants to maybe get in and do some other stuff as well. And they might have a shot here because the guy is obviously willing to entertain offers and ideas from anybody.
Well, the situation is this. I mean, I don't know if the viewers understand, but this is the first time GM has had a CMO that doesn't have any allegiance to the old guard of GM marketing.
Chief marketing officer, in case you don't know the CMO title.
This is such a dramatic fundamental shift for General Motors marketing. I don't even, words fail me because it's just unbelievable. And so this is really a new era. This is the one piece of the puzzle GM had to deal with if they were going to really succeed. They have good products on the ground. They've got good products coming. But if they can't sell them, they can't advertise or figure out to market them, they're going nowhere. So this is the last piece of the puzzle.
We've talked about this since the show began.
Yeah.
Remember, we were saying, remember with the debate on whether the Howie Long or whatever, those ads where they trash the Toyota and they trash the Dodge and stuff like that, were those good or not? It's always been a little suspect. And you're right, they have to match the good product they have out there.
Yeah.
Well, I know a guy who worked with Joe Lamonic, and I even asked him if I could use his name in telling the story, but he said, no, no, no.
What do you mean, Bill?
Even if you guess it right, I'm not going to admit to it. But several weeks ago, he told me, you know, Joel loves surprises, and Joel likes to show that he's in charge. And he claims this guy did, and this goes back several weeks ago, that he sent an email to Joel saying, you know, if you want the Detroit community eating out of your hand and really show that you're in charge, pull the Chevy business back to Campbell Ewald. So as soon as I saw your email yesterday of what's going in the column, I was like, oh, I forwarded it right to him and said, oh, my God, he did exactly what you said he should do.
But he took the chunk of Chevy business and put it to Goodby Silverstein & Partners. Mm. Jeff Goodby is his close ally.
Sure, they've worked together. Goodby had the Hyundai, Hyundai account before yeah. Hyundai pulled it back in-house to their own agency in Ocean. Joe and Jeff Goodby were pretty tight and worked together, so it's somebody he's comfortable with. Goodby had the Saturn account earlier part of the decade. I don't know how long they had it.
They had it for like a cup of coffee. No, it wasn't.
Was it really short?
Yeah, it was short. I think unless I change the title, my column next week is going to be 30 Days to Make History. That's what Jeff Goodby's got 30 days to come up with the first great Chevy campaign since the heartbeat of America.
Why would you give them a short deadline?
It's always better.
Yeah. Yeah. Pressure.
If you have too much time,
you'll think it through too much.
You'll overthink it.
And you'll committee it and so forth.
Yeah. So I would, 30 days, and then there might be subsequent meetings, but you know, you got.
I'm rooting for them because we have a giant chip on our shoulder in this city. It'd be nice if there was a win. So everybody doesn't feel like we're all stupid, because there have been a lot of leaders coming in here that have said everybody here in the auto industry is stupid, and there's a lot of talent around the city. And I'd love to see a win for those guys. So go get it, guys. You got it back. Don't screw it up.
Well,
29 days now.
Joe Iwanek and you know, the new agency he picks and any other he does for the other brand kind of have to succeed as well, because they've had so much turnover in marketing people, ad agencies, ad campaigns, taglines. You can't build a brand if you just keep switching. Even if you had good creative and you switch to new good creative, you've got to pick a brand.
Well, you know, as we said, Excellence for All was the Chevy campaign in question, which was a strategic line that never should have seen the light of day.
By the way, that Excellence for All, someone at Hyundai told me that they had actually weighed up that same tagline for some outdoor advertising, some billboards, and they ended up with Luxury for All for the Hyundai brand. And I don't know if they ever ended up using it, because Chevy came out with Excellence for All at the same time, but someone in the meeting had suggested Excellence for All, and the guys at Hyundai said, that doesn't say anything. It's boring, and they ditched it.
And they threw a phone at each other like the Koreans always do.
Well, don't forget, Excellence for All never saw the light of day. It's on the table, and that's
right.
When, you know, I knew there was going to be a shakeup at Chevrolet. I knew they couldn't go forward with that, so it doesn't surprise me.
Stuff like Excellence for All, Mark of Leadership, you've got these superlatives in there, but they aren't really taglines that make a really bold statement about the brand, and you sort of get this feeling.
Well, Excellence for All could be Target, you know.
Well, it
could be anything.
But it's not somewhere west of Laramie.
No,
it's not a dream. It's not like aspirational. It's
no,
just
it's
a
nothing.
A position.
Karl Marx said it first, yeah. Didn't he? Excellence for All.
But it's as if they don't have the confidence to really make a big statement about their brands.
Well, that's why Joel had to yank the. Yeah, they can.
But maybe things are starting to come together for GM. J.D. Power came out with a report today saying looks like GM sales are going good this month. up strong. In fact, they said looks like Toyota sales are struggling.
Edmunds put out a similar report.
Yeah, and then Monday this week, GM reported a profit of almost $900 million, you know, so not half bad. How do you read it, David?
Those were good numbers in a couple of different ways, too. First of all, $865 million net profit for the company.
Net,
that's
yeah.
a good quarter.
And, $1.2 billion in North America.
Yeah, $1.2 billion before interest and taxes in North America is very good. Remember, too, Ford made $828 million off Ford Credit in the same quarter. So if you were to add a similar profit or take that away from Ford, the numbers aren't that different. Opel is still dragging GM down. That lost $506 million, and you're going to see restructuring charges and problems there for a while. That could be the thing that really undercuts them. But this shows momentum. They made over $1 billion in their international operations, which is, you know, largely China and Brazil. But these are very good numbers. The other thing I really liked about it, and the sort of interestingly dull conference call with CFO Chris Liddell, is that these are really clean numbers. The old GM, we always got these quarters of earnings statements where if they had good numbers, there were a whole bunch of one-timers in there that they couldn't repeat that sort of sexed up some mediocre or poor performance. Or if they had really bad numbers, there were a whole bunch of reasonable explanations in there. Now you've got solid, clean numbers that say they're actually making progress. There are no ifs, ands, or buts about it. There's no BS in there. It's just pretty good earnings and pretty good progress. And Liddell was still trying to temper enthusiasm. The old GM was trying to varnish things and shine it up and tell you that, well, it's going to get better or it's better than it looks. And it was always reasonable explanations are what Rick Wagoner always had for us. And now we've got someone who's downplaying how quick the IPO could come and how good the numbers are and what we should expect for the rest of the year. It's a bit refreshing to not have to weed through a bunch of BS in their statement and you know, dig through some glossy statements.
Should GM have dumped Opel? To your point, they lost $500 million on Opel, no end in sight.
Actually, the half a billion they lost at Opel was less than I figured it was going to be. Now, the worst may be yet to come for a couple of reasons. The European market is pretty bad.
Well, the euro's just...
Yeah,
the
euro's getting trashed. There could be, you know, a bigger economic slowdown in Europe because of the financial crisis. So Joe Philippi, the analyst, told me that fixing Opel is like trying to catch a falling knife because you've got all of these other economic and financial problems, and that is going to be a problem trying to fix Opel. They're doing it in a strong wind now.
Here's the big problem I see is Opel's never going to get it profitable unless it's restructured. GM says it needs billions of euros to restructure it,
which is $7 now.
Yeah. But they were counting on all these European governments to give them billions of euros, and now those European governments have got to bail out Greece. Is GM going to get this money? And if it doesn't, you know, this is 2020 hindsight, right?
Will.
You know, I thought all along it was smart for them to keep Opel. Now I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was, too, because of their vehicle development programs. But
wait a couple years, and we'll be able to. It's too early to tell on that.
So what else is on your little magic list?
Well, one thing that I got, I don't know if you guys had heard, I went to the Bob Lutz open house retirement thing that GM had. Which was kind of interesting in a way, but he told me that
the tech center one or the rent center,
the tech center one,
because there was
two,
yeah. A short one.
There was
the
two,
center.
Right? But that wasn't open to outsiders like me.
I didn't get that memo. I wasn't invited.
I wasn't invited. They just posted something on their website that I happened to run across.
Oh, really?
And I admire Lutz, and I figure, hey, I'll go out and bid him a fair adieu, but he said he's going to become a car critic with Phil LeBeau from CNBC and go to different car shows and critique the new cars that are out there. And all I can think of is I can't wait for, let's put it a year or two down the road, if he's still doing it then, getting his comments on the new GM cars, especially if they didn't come out the way that Bob had thought they were going to come out.
Well, Bob can be immensely entertaining, and if he goes... You know, bare knuckles, full lambast on some of these things he doesn't like, it could be very entertaining. It'd be a lot of fun.
it could be a lot of fun. And I think that's probably why Phil LeBeau ran to him and said, hey, would you want to do this? And I'm sure Lutz leaped at the opportunity.
And CNBC has a ratings of Gilligan's Island's reruns. So anything
those.
They can do to help. The Gilligan's Island or
something. I love Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, I know.
Great stuff.
Thank you, Gilligan.
Did you like Ginger or Marianne?
I like Mary.
You like Marianne.
What about you?
I kind of like Marianne, but Ginger had her moments.
Yeah.
Marianne.
What about you?
You were fond of the professor, John?
Well, I wasn't fond of the professor because any guy who could make a radio out of coconuts but couldn't fix a hole in a boat is an idiot. Hey, what do you guys make of GM telling the UAW no more buyouts?
We looked at that story. I thought it was a non-story, to be honest with you.
Really? I think it's
buyouts
a big story.
Buyouts weren't in the contract to begin with. They negotiate them with the union when they need to downsize. GM doesn't need to downsize right now. The market is presumably at least going to go up, but they're running at a pretty good. They're running at 85% capacity in the first quarter.
In an
11 million market, and the union could always come back and say we want buyouts or something like that. There never was anything in the contract that said these guys get X amount of dollars. They negotiate it as these things go along, and if they are going to downsize again, all the contract says is you can't do it without negotiating it or under certain circumstances, economic acts of God, economic catastrophe, and all this sort of thing, and then they negotiate it. I don't see this as the end of all buyouts. That's not what really happened. I think the story that came out was there was a UAW sub-council meeting, I believe, where someone in the union, it was new to them, said there are no more buyout programs, which GM said a while ago when the buyout programs expired. And anyone who's, there are about 5,000 workers in the jobs bank, and any one of them, if they don't take a plant job somewhere else in the system in 2 years, they're just gone. But we already knew that. I mean, so... Hey,
I guess what I was reading into it is a week ago, Bob King, who will be the president of the UAW next month, came out and said, hey, we want to start getting those concessions back. We gave up all this stuff, blah, blah, blah.
You guys are going to get bonuses.
Right. But still, maybe I was reading too much into it, because what you're adding here, David, is really good
insight.
That's
what I think. And I ran some traps on that, and it sounded like all they were saying was that they don't have any buyout programs anymore, which had happened some time ago. And it doesn't sound like, to me, that buyouts are dead, gone, and buried forever. And I don't think the union would ever do that. I think the union is going to say if anyone needs to close plants or restructure again, you have to negotiate it because we gave in bankruptcy at GM and Chrysler, and we gave for the restructuring that they asked for. And we're going to see how the market goes. And if a couple of years down the line it gets sour or you screwed up and you need to restructure, then we're going to negotiate that again.
The big question for the UAW...
Look, the jobs bank isn't even gone.
No, it's not. The big question for the UAW is if they give Ford some of the cost savings if GM and Chrysler got through bankruptcy. And they're saying, hell no.
They're saying, hell no. But wait a minute, go back. The jobs bank's not gone? I thought the jobs bank was gone.
No, it's watered down a bit. You can't stay in it as long, but GM's got 5,000 workers there. Or on layoff. They don't get paid for as long. I think they still get the same amount of money. Frankly, I'm kind of trying to remember exactly what the terms were.
The terms basically were 95% of your take-home pay.
They had modified it, and the union agreed to do that, or they had suspended it indefinitely, but there's still workers who are awaiting reassignment.
Mm-hmm. That might be news for our leaders in Washington, because I think a lot of, and the consumer public,
sure,
think that jobs banks were eliminated.
I thought it was.
It never just went away completely. They didn't kill that off.
Boy, that's...
Yeah. I remember being at the press conference, and it was this massive auditorium with, they had briefed the union local leaders first, and then all the press came in, and it was a big deal, lots of cameras and everything. And I remember David Kiley and I are sitting there, and we looked at each other and said, so it's not gone. it's still there. It's just suspended.
I actually think it is.
Gone.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
I'm pretty sure it's gone. That's for the next show.
Yeah.
How many are left? We'll have them here.
Well, it's interesting. We, for Out of Line Detroit this weekend, we taped the show yesterday with Tom Stahlkamp from Chrysler, and was asking him what he thought of this A.T. Kearney report that the market's going to come roaring back, not this year, not next year, but after that, you know, boom, the floodgates burst open. And he was actually saying he hopes that does not happen because he says there's no way the supplier community can keep up. The big multinational suppliers, no problem, but he says people don't realize there's still thousands of small suppliers who can't get any credit right now and are simply not going to be able to ramp up. And if the industry persists in trying to, you know, meet this demand, if it does come out this way, he says the only way to solve it is throw a lot of cost at the problem.
Yeah, but wait a minute. It's going to go to, what, 17, 18 million again when you still have high unemployment? You have under reporting of unemployment because some people have given up. You have people underwater on their houses across
the
country.
You have a lot of underemployment.
Yeah, underemployment.
People who found jobs are making a lot less money.
And where is this going to come from? Part of the big 18 million SAR was just like the housing bubble. We were giving cars to people, selling cars to people that couldn't afford them.
It would probably be a blip.
When Gary Diltz was running the auto analysis over at J.D. Power, they had estimated that between home equity, cheap lease deals, these three-month contracts for rental with rental car companies where you bring the cars back, all of that stuff that had either created faster churn or just discounted cars, that the market was inflated by about 2 million units. And if you think about that, when we were at 16, 17, pushing 18, so we get back to a normalized rate because companies are pulling back on all of that, you're looking at, if things get really good, 13, 14, 15.
Right. All I'm saying is A.T. Kearney came out this week and said they see, and I'm trying to remember the date, was it 2014 or 15? They're saying 17.8 million. And I'm kind of with you, Jason. You know, it's like, where's this going to come from? Their argument was the average age of cars is the highest it's ever been in 60 years. And we're just building so much pent-up demand right now of people postponing their car purchase.
They're doing a little bit of bad analysis there. The average age of cars is older because cars are so much better than they, and there's a lot of factors. Cars are so much better, last a lot longer.
There's that, no question about it.
But people are avoiding the fashion purchase. I want a car that's, after I've had this one for 3 or 4 years, just because I can. People are putting that off.
Well, I saw the analysis of the recession of 89 through 92, and then the pent-up demand, and it just exploded 92 through 97.
Yeah, it did.
I've not seen any charts, and I see charts like that once in a while. I don't see this grotesque pent-up demand.
Remember something,
it's
too.
It's not true.
And I did a cover story on this last year. That's the plug portion of the show, by the way, is what happened to baby boomers. They're set to retire in 5 or 10 years. Home equity was wiped out, and their investments have been hammered in the market. Took another big beating today, and they simply don't have all the money hanging around as they're getting closer to retirement. So they're either buying cheaper cars or they're holding off. And other purchases, too, vacationing, dining out. There are a lot of things that the spendthrift generation just can't afford to do anymore, and they're nervous, and it's going to be a while before the younger generations come up behind them. Gen X is coming up behind the boomers. We're a smaller generation.
Did you see Joe Queenan's piece in the Journal about these college grads coming out?
No.
What did he say? It's
depressing.
Oh, geez.
There are no jobs for these kids.
Yeah, unemployment in Gen Y is 16 or 17.
They're lucky to get a pizza job with graduate degrees. So this group of kids coming out of school is screwed for a while. So they're not going to be buying. They're not like the kids coming out in the 80s with greed is good and stuff like that after that recession, and they could buy a car and they were getting multiple offers.
I thought I had it bad when I graduated in 92, and that was a recession and it was a bad one, but it's nothing like this.
92?
I graduated in 92. There were no jobs out there. It was pretty awful.
That was a bad time, especially in the auto industry. Hey, but switching topics here, Peter, Honda's top R&D guy came out this week and said, electric cars? We don't think so. We don't think people are going to buy these things.
Well, that was encouraging, number one, because I know you like Honda. I do, too. It's just they've always gone their own way, which I appreciate that. But the electric car thing is really one part of a giant picture, and I think the electric, everyone's jumping on an electric car train, but that train's pretty short. has a pretty short reach, and yeah, in urban centers, it's going to work out. And for the
if you have a place to plug
it
in.
Yeah, and for the few fops in Silicon Valley that just have to have a Tesla or whatever, the electric car.
And just before I left, Tesla and Toyota have some joint project, I guess, coming where they're going to build electric cars at NUMMI, I think?
I just saw that as we were coming in here. I haven't had a chance to find out what that's all about.
What CEO 4 years ago was the most negative on electric cars?
You're going to say Carlos Ghosn.
Absolutely.
No, he was down on hybrids.
No, he was down on electric cars and hybrids. And now he's just greener than green on electric cars.
He's all in.
All in.
Right.
He's coming to town next week.
Really? Is he going to be online after hours?
He should be.
He should be.
He should email Simon.
He knows what's good for his public
image.
He'll be sitting
right here.
What's
he coming to town for?
Economic Club of Detroit, I think.
Yeah, but for...
Is that on Tuesdays?
Interesting.
Or Mondays?
I'm not sure.
Sure
it can vary.
Tuesday. Well, anyway, I just think the Honda guy, he's just trying to put some perspective out there. In urban centers and where you can plug them in, they'll have a role, but are we all going to be driving? Is it going to... 50% of the American fleet going to be electric? No. No way.
Well, I'm a little suspect when auto executives start trashing one technology or the other because it's usually the one where they're furthest behind.
Right.
Whether it's hybrids.
That's a good point.
Honda does have, very impressive hydrogen fuel cell work. And
they have impressive hydrogen fuel cell work in natural gas cars. Their hybrid program is not very good. And if your hybrid program isn't that good, then... by extension, your electric car program is going to have some issues, too, because you probably don't have the battery work.
But I agree with his assessment that the limited range thing.
There's no question about that.
The vast majority of car buyers are going to go, wait a minute, what do you mean it goes 80 to 100 miles? That's not enough. And then I got to wait how many hours to recharge it? That's what this guy is saying. Tomohiko Watanabe, I think, is his name. Name to watch because, the career path in Honda is whoever is running Honda R&D typically ends up as the CEO of the company.
And don't forget, we've all talked about this, the internal combustion engine has a long way to go.
Up to 70% more
efficiency.
According to AVL and Ricardo.
Right.
We've talked about this before, but just 4 or 5 years ago, the automakers were saying, if you ratchet up CAFE, everyone's cars are going to be these, tiny Ford Focuses with, three-cylinder engines and this sort of thing. And now we've got Camaros and Mustangs at over 300 horsepower and 29-30 mpg. A lot of its direct injection has become more affordable and more usable in the past few years.
Well, advanced transmissions, too.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. No, it's the whole package, as you guys know.
They're ringing. Actually, I'd say it's more than ringing if you're getting Mustangs and Camaros with this kind of performance. And they're not expensive cars.
Right.
The first direct injection engines were from Audi, and they were great, but they were pretty expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're putting them in every man's pony cars and getting great performance and mileage out of them.
And the other thing, too, is, biofuels keep growing in production, ethanol in particular, and, it might be. Interesting to point out that in our area right now, there's a gas station 2 miles up the road here where you can buy E85 for 50 cents a gallon cheaper than regular gasoline. It's the magical 22%.
Does that make it on par then?
Yes.
Because it has less calories.
Right. And so, you need a 20% drop in the price if you have a flex fuel vehicle to come out.
It's a 20% drop in fuel.
In fuel economy. Yeah. People say 30%, and that's right. But they forget that E85 has 15% gasoline in it. So you don't lose 30% with E85. You lose about 20%, 20, 22%. But in certain places in the Midwest, Colorado, Nebraska,
Iowa,
you can buy E85. I looked it up today, $1.80 a gallon. $1.80. And now all of a sudden, you're way ahead of the game.
Forrest, run!
Hey, and then the other thing, though, Peter, we got to talk about is this hybrid that Porsche raced at the 24 Hours of Nürburgring this last weekend.
With the Williams Engineering flywheel system, which is...
With a flywheel. No batteries in this hybrid. It stores energy in a flywheel, and then they use that spinning flywheel to generate electricity to goose this thing when you're coming on the straight.
And they have to wait, was it laps or corners to churn it up again?
Well, you regain the energy in braking. Yeah. Right.
It sounds like something MacGyver would have made.
Or MacGruber.
Or some goober.
I think it's very cool. And, if we see that in racing, we're probably going to see it at Le Mans for sure. And we're going to see it in the American Le Mans Series. And it's all good, you know.
I find, number one, I was blown away. 200 cars started the race.
Oh, yeah.
I just can't imagine 200 cars in a race. That's mind-blowing itself. And then within an hour, the Porsche was fighting for the lead, and then they cut a tire, got a flat, dropped to the back, charged to the front again because they're getting 25% better fuel economy, ergo they don't have to make as many pit stops, and it blowed up.
Yeah, the flywheel broke, and they ended up in France.
Yeah.
Boing, boing.
Who was the mad cartoonist who died a couple years ago? Don...
Oh, yeah.
Never mind. Don Martin.
Oh, Don Martin.
Yeah. Mad Magazine.
Mad Magazine, you bet.
Yeah, with the guys with the shoes that are the feet.
The floppy feet.
Yeah, it's just.
Spy versus Spy. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I'm.
Oh, here we have images.
Yeah, at the race in the Porsche 911 GT3R.
God, these drivers look like they're in high school.
Because they are.
By the way, you enthusiasts out there, if you can ever muster the logistics to go, you should go to the Nordschleife of the Nürburgring.
The old track.
It's just beyond comprehension. I had, at one of my agency stints, I was working on Pontiac. We launched the Fiero, and I was asked to help on a general tire project, and I didn't want to do it. You know, it's just because I was all into Pontiac, and it was all I could do to keep up with what I was trying to do. So they said, you're the only one who really knows this stuff. You got to do it. You got to help us. So I did. And so what I did is I came up with a campaign that I was absolutely sure they would not approve. Because when we went down to Akron, the first time I went down, it was like going back to 1942. It was unbelievable. You land at that airport, which is untouched. I mean, it hasn't changed in 60 years, and I just said, oh, this is okay. You want me to work on this? And I'm going to come up with a campaign to launch this. It was like the XP2000 tire. It's their first real high-performance tire in a long time. And I say, okay, good. We're going to get Audis, Mercedes, BMWs, and we're going to go to the Nürburgring in Germany, and we're going to shoot for a week there and 10 days, and we're going to do all this, and it's going to be great. I had these boards, and I'm selling this, and I said, oh, I'll never buy this. So we get on the plane the next day. We love it. I said, really?
Were you on the Viper GTS launch?
I was. I was just going to ask you about that. Were you at Chrysler then?
Yeah, I was running that with Kowalewski.
That was one of the all-time greatest press trips in the world.
We went to the Nürburgring Spa and
Reims.
Right.
But remember who crashed, the only crash at Nürburgring?
Right behind him.
Was Phil Hill.
Right.
With journalist Bob Stork, who soiled himself.
He was a passenger.
Phil admitted he blamed it on the brakes at first.
Blamed it on it at first.
But then later he goes, I just kind of had a little senior moment. Phil, rest in peace, a wonderful, wonderful gentleman.
Great guy.
And who was the great photographer along the way with us? Jesse Alexander.
Jesse Alexander, right.
Who shared photos back in the day, Phil Hill and stuff like that. But that was such...
This was an incredible trip because, as Jason mentioned, we flew into Germany. I think we started there.
We flew into Hamburg.
We went to the Nürburgring. And you've got Viper GTSs and Viper convertibles.
The only ones in the world.
And it's like
12 of them.
Here's a helmet, and there's the cars, and there's the track. Go at it. And it was like, yowza. This is like unreal.
And being the PR guy, we let the journalists go first. By the time I got in the car, it was a hot day. Remember when we got there, it was pretty warm. I was on the back stretch, and I wanted to get top speed at 165. I got it to 165. I'm going to the turn, and I had no brakes. And I was like, oh, shit.
I was just going to say the brakes must have been smoking.
Downshifting. I took the corner at 125. I thought I was dead. And finally got back to the paddock and just, I soiled myself as Bob Stork had. But it was fun. And then drive the best part of the trip. I'm sorry to reminisce for people listening and watching.
Then we went to Spa.
We went to Spa, which was fun.
Then we went to Rames, which is ghost town of a racetrack.
Yeah, it's still there.
Oh, it's and yeah. I've got great photos. You've been in my house. Great photos in the stands. It's a ghost town.
It is a ghost town.
And then we had dinner that night at a little French place, a little French hotel. And I remember Castaing was going to go see his family. And he came back. I go, how was it? And he just put his finger up. The next day, we drove into Paris. And we staged
Stopped
the cars.
The city.
And
pole.
Who? I got to give him credit. Former Ford PR guy. Rex Greenslade had arranged where we stopped, and we went around the Arc de Triomphe. We just stopped traffic. People stopped, and these 13 Vipers came around. We did a loop, and then we went down the...
like the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still. It was like as these Vipers came down the Champs-Élysées, everything is... People are just stopping. All these Vipers coming down. People, you know, knocking over the tables in the cafes, running to the edge of the sidewalk to see what the hell is going on here. What are all these Vipers coming down the street?
We were all on fumes. Right. We were all on fumes. My wife was in the car with me. I'm thinking, somebody's going to run out of gas and the French are going to beat us up. And then I realized, it's French, they're not going to beat us up. But we had so much fun. It was
Stayed at the George Sank there, too.
The King George?
King George.
Yeah. And fabulous, the photos on the cover of Auto Week and a few other publications. It was just one of those moments where you go, I love being in the car business. This is fun. The passion of automobiles.
It was cool. It was a really good trip.
So enthusiasts out there, you should really make an effort to go once in your life. It's like going to the cathedral of speed.
Yeah.
Oh, and when I went there, we shot this commercial over about an eight-day period, and my buddy Jeff Swart was over with us shooting all the still stuff. So we brought a Fiero over there. We did some Pontiac stuff. And the entire time we were shooting there, the track was closed. It wasn't rented. But it was late October. We stayed at this hotel by the track, and they cut their heat off. I mean, it was just... But the coolest thing was we had the track to ourselves, and then the entire time we found out NATO... in the late fall does their low-altitude flying stuff over the Nürburgring because there's no people there. And these jets were coming so low that you could see the markings on their helmets.
Whoa.
When they banked over us because they were looking to see what we were doing. It was just like an orgy of speed on the track, in the sky. It's great.
Give people a sense of how big this is.
It's hard.
Well,
to...
it's 14 miles, right?
No, but the track is 14, but the whole landscape.
Oh yeah, well, you have a whole forest.
It's not. It's not an oval at Indy.
Yeah,
it's,
no, right. It just goes off of the countryside, and we had a crack team of German drivers, so I could follow them and they could show me stuff. But the funniest bit to this day, when I mentioned this to Jeff, we laugh uncontrollably. He was following me in a Porsche Targa that the factory let him borrow because he's a friend of the factory, has been for a long time. So we finish a shoot. He said, okay, that's a wrap. So I said, okay. And I had a Mercedes 190 or something. So I take off, and Jeff jumps in his Porsche, and we're going down there, and I'm doing good. I go through three corners, like, hanging the tail out, drifting. I felt like a hero. And I crested this hill, and I forgot where the track went. I just was like, oh. And we were going way too fast for a left-hand sweeper, and I slid way off, and Jeff thought we were going to roll it. And we didn't. I think.
What were you driving?
A 190 Mercedes, you know. And we got up on two wheels, but I didn't roll it. Didn't hit anything. It was just like, okay.
All right, yeah. Question. Did you saw it?
No, it didn't. I was just all adrenalized and just like, this is cool.
And Dave wishing that somebody had shot the whole thing, too, caught it on video.
Jeff still laughs when we talk about it.
Dave Barnes at GM now will testify. I was driving, and he was my passenger, and I missed a turn going too fast, and we went into the infield. It was a turn to the left. I missed it. We did, I think, four complete loops in the car at 120 miles per hour, and, you know, not a sound from the driver or passengers, just a...
No, that really...
And you stop and
really
you just go...
Freeze.
And now you can go and you can pay to lap it.
Right.
And, boy, they have all kinds of accidents. I mean, you're going out there and you'll go buy like a 1960 Citroen, and then some guy will go buy in a turbo Porsche, and then another guy will go buy in a bike, sport bike, and then someone crashes, and it's just, it's something, though. It's worth it.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's such a long track, 14 miles, that you just can't go there and learn the track in 20 minutes.
Someone tell me the amount of laps you need to I forget, but there is an amount of laps you have to do before you start remembering.
Yeah, and you know, a key reason is there are several turns and several hills that are very similar, at least to a novice like me going out there. It was like, oh, yeah, I know exactly where I am. And like you say, you crest the hill and you realize, oh, this isn't the turn
There's
I was
no
thinking
road
about.
Left.
And we were short of it. One day shooting, we were short of a driver, so I was the third driver in these three cars, and we were going over Flugplatz flat out, and we got air a little bit, just enough. But we were so close to each other that one false move and we were all dead.
It's kind of like driving on 275.
Yeah, really.
Right.
But it was cool.
Except that every major road in the area is under construction right now, so
yeah, you're right.
Can't get going faster than 20.
You can't get here.
What else is on your list, Dan?
Well, I think it's time for rapid fire. I think we've got to ask Ben to bring up
actually,
the graphic.
One thing.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Jeff Green tells me that by text here while we were talking.
Also
I was
Bloomberg.
Right, the jobs
also Bloomberg.
Also
a
Bloomberg.
Yes.
That the jobs bank does exist. It phases out. You can only stay in it for 2 years. I was right about that. But and you can sit there for 2 years, but it does phase out, but it's not gone.
How many people are in it?
At GM,
5,000.
At GM, it's 5,000. I don't know what the other companies have.
Yeah, very interesting. But, Ben?
Remember, that was the thing. They wanted to take care of every year. They bought a lot of people out, and they wanted to make sure that nobody just got dispatched. So the misleading thing is, at the time, the public thought, okay, it's gone, so these companies can restructure and just hand people a pink slip and give them 2 weeks' pay, and that was it. And that's not what happened.
Well,
and it's not what happened.
I didn't think that they
either.
Could pink slip them that much. But, you know, the jobs bank drove a lot of bad behavior.
Sure it did.
Because it was like that's where the whole push model really
Absolutely.
Kicked into gear.
Absolutely.
And that's not good in my book to hear that it's still around.
But they are phasing it out. And to the point I was making, none of the companies are cutting back right now. They're all down to a point. Even Chrysler's, you know, roughly break even right now. They're all down to the point with the cuts that they've made where as long as we don't have a serious double dip in the recession and the market goes back to 9.5 or 10, they shouldn't have to negotiate buyouts or deal with the jobs
right.
bank and put more people
I talked
it.
To a Wall Street Journal reporter at lunch earlier this week, and he said he finally feels good about the industry. And he was a real skeptic that GM has a ways to go, but they're doing good. They got great products. Ford's doing great. They got this debt load that's scary, but... And Chrysler has made it through a death valley
yeah.
with no new products and had sales uptick. Dealers are feeling better. They're not all profitable, but they're feeling better. They got the Grand Cherokee's breakthrough great. And they got through death valley.
I hope it does well for them.
I do too. Well, yeah. for all of us here in this community and the suppliers throughout the country. And, you know, we haven't talked about it. We won't for... 5 seconds, Toyota's spiral has brought everybody up
yeah,
on almost an equal plane.
This is something I was saying on Bloomberg TV. They asked me after GM's earnings, well, aren't the, and this was actually Bloomberg TV Asia, aren't the Asian automakers still really, you know, powerful and taking a whoop and stick to these guys? And I said, you know, right now, there's a window that GM and the others can get through because Toyota has its obvious recall problems, and you're seeing it show up in brand image surveys. Honda has lost its mojo. I'm sorry. You know, we've talked about this a lot, but all of the new vehicles they've launched, other than their main bread-and-butter Civic, Accord, and CR-V, have been flops. Nissan's doing pretty well, and Hyundai has a lot of momentum, but it's not this Hyundai and Toyota show that no matter what Detroit does, they can't crack through that.
Well, much like when the Detroit 3 brought each other down, no matter how good one was doing, they brought each other down. Toyota brought down the Japanese, all of them, Honda, Nissan, and so forth. You saw a report out, 3 weeks ago, that more Americans think domestic quality is better than Asian quality and stuff
right.
like that. This
First
is how these
ever, right.
these snowballs impact.
First time I've seen that in my lifetime.
And so it's time for GM, Ford, and Chrysler to just put the pedal to the metal on quality and so forth. And because this is gonna last, this little perception thing is not going to last forever.
Take advantage of it now, boys.
All right.
Okay, let's bring up that graphic that has Mr. Vines in his headband and machine gun.
I'm sorry. They did?
Yeah, they announced that they're working on it.
Is Scott going to be Dr. Evil?
Well, see, my scenario for it is they're in suburbia, totally removed. He's not an evil genius anymore.
Dr. Evil, is it?
Yeah, they live in suburbia, and they're just think this is it. This is like being on the witness protection program. So I can see it.
And he snaps out of it and goes, I need to be evil again.
Yeah.
And he goes and sees Scott's kind of screwed it up.
Really? I'm sorry. That's okay. Okay, Jason Jadosh, and I know I butchered your name, Jason. I'm sorry, but he says,
Jason
so
Jedi?
Peter. What?
Jason Jedi?
No. It looks like Jadosh is how I'm going to say it.
Force is with you.
But it's a lot of consonants there. Anyway, he says, so Peter, which Mopar vehicle would you choose to reshape the recent lousy ad image?
Well, my column this week was about these just horrific minivan spots, which I even refuse to describe because that would give, what's his name?
Olivier?
Yeah, satisfaction. Oh, well, if you're talking about them, then they're working. No, they're not working. Well, you really only got, as far as image, you've got Charger or Challenger. It's not the Ram truck. Ram is a nice truck, but it's not going to be an image thing. So that's what you got.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, what's the best automotive tagline? I think he probably means what's out there now.
Oh, no, the best one the company gave away, threw away. Quality is job one.
Yeah.
I think is still one of the greatest taglines of all time.
Engineered like no other car in the world and the ultimate driving machine.
There you go.
We've talked about those. Those are great.
Right. Anything now, today, that really stands out?
Remember the movie Real People or Crazy People, Dudley Moore? They were the ad agency for Chrysler.
We want to build you a car in the worst way.
Well, also, they had a Jaguar ad.
What is Volvo's?
They've lost their safety thing.
Yes. So, Volvo for life.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Okay, what's GM's? Well, it's all over the board.
Well, the different brands.
Yes. What's Ford's
class,
now?
World class for Buick, I think, is pretty good. It's not one of the best.
Yeah,
Ford is Drive One.
Drive One. That's not bad.
No, it's coming.
Which is better than the change after Nasser, which was Look Again. That was a horrible one.
Yeah. What is Kia's? Because those ads when they've got the stuffed animals in the cars and
my wife
those are awesome.
Bad.
I know. My wife goes nuts when they, especially with the stuffed monkeys getting the tattoo sewn into his arm and it's playing that tune, How Do You Like Me Now?
How Do You Like Me Now?
It's a great ad.
I don't know what Subaru's is.
Cadillac had a great one, the standard of the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Subaru. I don't know. I hear they're trying to broaden out, and I hate when companies try to do this.
Subaru is the most successful car company going right now for what they are. They're amazing.
Every time they get greedy and they go away from the core buyer that loves them, they get stupid and they water down the products and the marketing that appeals to the core, but they can't stray enough from what that core is to appeal to the mass market, and they end up just pissing everybody off. We'll see how they execute this thing. But
well, it's just like BMW with this Joy business, but we talked about that, so let's move on.
Is there, Jay Cujo wants to know, is there any chance that you can get Mark Royce back on the show? Yeah, better yet, what about Bob Lutz? We are going to get Bob Lutz. I talked to him about it this week. He said, don't even talk to him for the next 2 weeks. He's in some mega transition of leaving GM, but I'm sure we can get Mark back at some point, and we're definitely going to get Lutz on the show. Ben, I see we've got some phone calls. Why don't we bring one in here?
Hi, John McElroy. This is GM employee. I have a question for you about Buick. Buick announced today that the new Regal GS will be out and about soon enough. I wonder what your thoughts are on the Buick GS. Have you seen it? Have you heard anything about it? Or have you even seen the Opel derivative, the Insignia? Just wonder what your thoughts are on it. Thank you.
Yeah, Regal GS, I think, is going to be a good move for Buick. I think it's smart for them to come out with a performance product. We've seen the car. Didn't they have it at the Detroit show?
Yes.
I know I've seen it. Nice wheels to it, different exhaust system, chrome tip dual exhaust, and being an Opel-derived product, I'm pretty sure it's going to be a true driver's car.
Stylistically, not as cool-looking, I think, as the LaCrosse, but pretty tasteful. The Insignia sold well in Europe and China, so...
I see the Buicks on the road. They are drop-dead gorgeous cars. Just drop-dead gorgeous. And as I pull aside them, what do I see driving them still?
Old people.
Uh-huh. Cadillac has that issue, too. So does Lincoln.
Well, I think
and,
probably
and
one
as I'm getting close to being an old person, and you officially are.
Right. Yeah, I've crossed that line.
It's still a question of, you know, they're gangbusters in China. Can they really survive as a brand in this country?
Well, LaCrosse has been out for less than a year, and that's the car that would bring in somebody who's younger. The Enclave,
but they're
actually
not bringing in people that are younger. They're not. I've not seen a young person driving a LaCrosse.
Give them time. Give them time. They need products.
I hope
they need things like a Regal GS.
I'm rooting for them to do it because the quality and the feel of the cars is so fantastic.
Tonya, what do you think of this, Jason? Instead of bringing the Pontiac G8 back as a Caprice, bring it back as a Buick Super 8 and make it a rear-drive sports car. That would get some young people into the brand, some young guys who like sporty cars and rear-drive and manual transmissions.
But they wouldn't do it because you'd rather invest in Chevy and build up the core brand.
No question, but if... Look, we're back to a problem GM has always had, even though they're down to four brands, is that there are really cool ideas to help out some of the other brands, but for making money and for the interest of the company, you really want to put whatever it is into Chevy very often, so...
Matt Bashi writes in. He says, what are your thoughts on the news breaking this evening that Tesla and Toyota are teaming up to build electric cars at NUMMI? I say they're in fantasy land since the plant is over 5 million square feet and has capacity for 400,000 cars or trucks. I think he's right. I think they're crazy to go into NUMMI. This is a public relations move. It's not a
well,
business
It's a public one. Relations move in part because Toyota took a bath perception-wise for helping close NUMMI.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the conspiracy theorists who think Obama Motors, GM, and Chrysler are hurting Toyota through this all this recall in the Washington stuff as a payback for NUMMI. I've seen the blogs for closing NUMMI. I don't know. I guess using part of a plant.
They can't be using the whole thing.
Oh,
NUMMI can't make 300,000 cars a year.
You could build them in the administration office.
I mean, Tesla sold, what, a couple hundred cars, maybe 500 cars, maybe?
Yeah. I think they've sold more than 1,000. I thought it was 1,200.
Maybe something
it
like that.
It might be up around there, but clearly, you know, just to lock into the overhead of heating and cooling and property taxes and a security and blah, 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 to go into a facility like that is nuts.
NUMMI was one of Toyota's highest cost plants, if not their highest cost plant, because the workforce was old, so they're all making top wage. And they had UAW benefits. And that plant had really high utility costs because it's in California. So, you know, I hope they can get some concessions from the utilities and the government in California to make it work.
This is just as crazy as Fisker going into the plant where they built Wilmington. Sky and in Wilmington.
But I think that plant's a lot smaller than NUMMI.
It's
not
little,
paying California taxes and utilities.
They'll
get
overkill.
Breaks on that stuff, I assume. But
it's going to be interesting to see how fast Tesla and Fisker blow through the cash the government gave them.
Yeah.
I say it's going to be fast.
Hey, we got another phone call here, Ben. Let's bring it in.
Hi, this is Gene Dickerson. I'm just calling to ask if you fellows have heard anything about where the NASA engineers have uncovered anything about the Toyota unintended acceleration investigation.
Nothing's come through yet.
Yeah, nothing's come out of that. NASA and the National Academy of Sciences are conducting their own investigation separate, not involving Toyota at all, to determine if electronics are causing this unintended acceleration. As Peter said, nothing's come of it. Believe me, they are going to crunch their supercomputers for about 2 years and say, you know what?
Looks like
it's driver error.
Looks like the foot was on the wrong pedal.
Right. That's exactly what they're going to find out.
And there were sticky pedals, yes.
Yes.
And there were floor mat issues.
Yes.
And all the circumstances around every incident was exactly the same.
Okay, Miradart says, I know this is a dumb question. Actually, it's not a dumb question, and we get asked this every so often, but is there an exact definition for the car classes, A class, B class, C class, D class?
Depends on what continent you're on. Actually, they have definitions by continent, but in Europe, a C car is, the way they talk about it, it's a little different than what it is here. But basically, you're talking A cars are like smarts, right?
Yep.
B car is a subcompact like Fit, Aveo, that sort of thing.
Fiesta.
C is Focus, Cruise.
Kind of caliber.
Civic.
Yeah. Right. D car is your midsize.
D car is your actual midsize, and then
your Accord, your Cam, not your Camry, almost anymore. See, right. And as the old D cars get bigger,
yeah, and then right. You have Super B class or B plus, and then you have CD class.
Well, that stuff, yeah, that's
you know, because there's no hardcore definition. But go to, I think Wikipedia's actually got a pretty good list of that sort of thing, and just go by the European one.
You're referring our listeners and our viewers to Wikipedia?
I use it for all my research.
Oh, excuse me. Go to Bloomberg.
Go to Bloomberg and pay money.
Buy a terminal.
Yeah.
Buy a terminal for $25,000.
And a two-year contract.
Oh, my God.
Oh, the phone calls are pouring in. Ben, let's go to them.
This is Mayor Bloomberg. Stop dissing my guy.
Hi, guys. It's Jeff W. from Albany, New York again.
Uncle
my
Mike.
Question is, in Peter's recent blogs, we've heard a lot lately about some of the lame auto advertising he has seen as of late. My question is, besides Audi, which brand does he think is doing a good job lately? Actually, I'd be interested to hear the rest of the panel as well. You know, in my opinion, much of the auto advertising I see lately, it's all pretty bland. Thanks. Take care.
Yeah. Amen. It is pretty bland.
Audi is doing some good stuff.
Audi's doing some good stuff. There's actually one ad that I tell you, every time I hear it, it stops me cold, but it's only because of the music. Acura for the ZDX does this one ad, with, and it just starts out with this tango music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's a very nicely done ad, and someone emailed me the name of the group. It's very nicely done for the ZDX. That yeah. The woman is looking at the ZDX passing by. It's a design statement. It's an ergonomic nightmare, and it's $60,000.
Right, but we're talking about the ad.
But the commercial's cool.
Right.
I love the Volkswagen ads, the new ones, with the hitting each other in the arm in the old.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, playing slug bug only
slug
with
bug, and with the guy goes, he hits him after it is a Volkswagen after all, and he goes, you hit like my sister, and goes, I'd like to meet your sister.
I don't know. I don't know if it does. It doesn't say much about the car, but it makes you watch the ad.
Well, the best part of the ad is where they have Stevie Wonder at the ad, and he punches the guy next to him when he goes red one, and the guy goes, "How do you do that?"
The reason they did those ads is because they did a bunch of market research, and all consumers think of when they think of Volkswagen is the Beetle and the Jetta, and they wanted to get people thinking because you see the other VWs that they have with the cars. Yeah, I like the Kia ads, obviously. One of the coolest ones out there is which tire company is a Bridgestone Firestone with the Mr. Potato Heads driving in the cars?
That's been out for a while.
I haven't seen it.
I know it's
one.
Been out for a while, but it's a good car.
I haven't.
But I think the question is dead on. Other than the Kia ad that I like, there's not a lot out there that's really exciting.
Right? Yeah, it's few and far between. For visual interest, there's the C-Class Mercedes barrel rolling towards the camera.
Yeah, but the only problem is I've seen it too much.
Yeah, they run it
too much. I'm sick of that.
And I remember seeing research a long time ago for auto show displays and stuff like that when we first started showing crash cars at the auto show saying, don't remind people that you could get killed in this product. It just doesn't help.
Well, yeah, I think manufacturers forget, when you go to auto show, people want to be entertained.
Right.
They want the fantasy stuff. They don't want to be reminded that, it's about $5.99 a month. And, here's our safety video. Here's this thing.
Remember Uncle Ralph got killed last month in a car.
Here's this thing going into a barrier at 40 miles. People don't want that.
No. Right.
And so, I see these manufacturers go, we're real earnest about our safety. Well, that's good, but what do you got to show? What do you got to wow the crowd? Yeah. Well, we got nothing. Okay.
Show us the dream. Yeah. Show us the promise. Okay, Ben, let's go with another call.
Hey, guys. Marty in Atlanta. I've noticed a styling trend with vehicles with car design where the belt lines are real high and the cars have gun-slit windows. Is that a styling-only type of thing? Is there something else going on? I can't stand them. I hate it. Can't see out of the vehicle, and you certainly can't back them up. And you actually do need lane departure and backup cameras and all such silliness. My 20-year-old GTI, I knew exactly where all four corners were because I could see out of the car. What say you? Thanks.
Well, the pedestrian protection.
Well, the first car that really got us down that road was the 300.
Right.
Yep.
And which is great. Ironic that it came from Chrysler.
Yeah.
Because in the mid 90s, we were selling the LH products that had 360 vision around, and how that was a safety issue.
Nice open greenhouses.
Nice open, and the DLO is Tom Gale, a daylight. What is it? Daylight opening, and then to go to the 300, where you had slabs of metal, and everybody followed. Look at every Ford car.
What came out first?
Real quick, is the surveys that were done showed people felt good about that. They like the metal around them.
They like it up above their shoulder.
And even though visibility is an issue now in almost every car out there.
Well, look at the Camaro and the Challenger.
What came out first, the Z4 or the 300? Because they really moved the belt line up on the Z4 compared to the old Z3. And Bangle told me it's because the Z3, he almost felt like it was an immature design, and you sort of felt like you were up like this. And
well, the
Z4, you were kind of down and in.
The Z3 had very clown car tendencies about it.
And the Z4, you're really down in. I like the high belt lines because I like those chop top 40s hot rod kind of looks. But pedestrian protection also plays a role because they're moving hoods up.
Hood lines are going up.
And if you're going to trail one line all the way back beneath the greenhouse, it's going to move the overall.
So if you're going to hit the pedestrian, hit them solid. The thing is, though.
Well, they don't want initial, sharp
and
stuff.
It still is with the 300. Now, all these cars, if you pull up to a stop light and you're first at the light, what do you have to do to see whether the light changed? You have to look out. You have to go into your windshield and look up.
Saab used to sell a little mirrors that you'd put down on the dashboard because they took their roof line with their curved windshield so far forward that it was an aftermarket thing. You'd put this little mirror down so you could see the light changing without having to crane your neck.
It's going to be interesting to see how the 9.5 looks, or it does, because it looks really interesting.
It looks like the best Saab that's come down the road in a long time.
Yeah.
Let's bring in another phone call, Ben.
Hi, Ikey.
Hi, Jim Campbell here, calling from Calgary. Couple quick things.
Calgary.
Yes, that Alan Milani from Ford seems to be getting the marketing down a little bit better. They seem to be doing the features and benefits of the vehicles just a little bit more highlighted. I mean, Ford F-150 beat both Chevy and GMC truck sales there last month. So obviously a little bit more happening there with the marketing. Also, I guess the other thing is General Motors, does General Motors actually have a full financing program that's available to Ford and to Toyota and to Dodge? I mean, I think Ford Credit's still out there, where General Motors is actually more relying on some of the outside lending forces to help get their deals done. So that means, in some ways, that it's actually a bit of a hindrance that they're overcoming. Anyway, great show, guys.
Well, GM's trying to change that.
Yeah, you
know. Yeah, they are. But right now they still use GMAC, and there have been complaints from the executives.
Mark Royce.
Royce was saying that GMAC doesn't buy as deep into the credit tiers, and they could sell more cars. They do it for leasing. They use GMAC, but they also have a deal with U.S. Bank, which actually offers some pretty competitive lease, but not as much. They don't have the capacity or the depth. It is a hindrance. They also don't get the profits from it. We talked about that
right at
the beginning of the show.
Very, very critical, and they're going to have to get back into it. GMAC, known as Ally, now.
That's right.
Ally. And Ally has said we don't want any of these subprime guys, and that's especially what Royce was talking about. They want to go after subprime. And I was astonished to learn that something like 20% of Honda buyers are subprime. So it's not
careful
just
careful with that, because that may be right, but there's subprime, there's non-prime, which is, like, I think in the like high 500s and 600s, and those aren't bad. 600s are not bad credit ratings, and some banks just don't want to touch it. Experian Automotive has a good ranking of all this, because there is a non-prime category. The thing is, I was talking to a guy in sales at GM the other day, and he was saying, look, some of these buyers that GMAC or other banks don't want to touch, their credit isn't prime, but it's pretty close, and people pay their car payment before they pay their mortgage if they hit the skids, because they need the car to get to work.
To get away.
Or to get away, right. But you can always get rid of your house and get a cheap apartment and downsize. But if you have your car, you don't get to work. And people pay that first. It's during the whole mortgage meltdown, the captive finance companies and auto lending businesses were still doing pretty well.
From the finance world, though. It's easier to hide a car than a house.
Sure.
I'm serious.
So the repo man.
Repo man.
Although one of the sports writers at the paper, my first job, got repoed, and he didn't even have a house. He was sleeping on my couch a couple of weeks, another writer's couch another week, and they still found him.
Hey, we got some more calls. Let's use these up here, Ben.
This is Jim from Sioux Falls. E85 is a dollar a gallon less here, too. But I'm just wondering, do you guys think that the oil spill will have any long-term effect on people's attitudes about alternative fuel vehicles? Enjoy the show. Thanks.
That's a good question. I think this disaster in the Gulf is going to have huge ramifications in a lot of different fronts. And I think people are going to be much more receptive to the investigation of alternatives to this.
I'm with you, Peter. I think this could be a tipping point for oil.
Yeah.
I think, you know,
this is a look, we're talking.
I'm all for let's get lots of energy and let's drill. But man, this is a disaster.
I can't stop it.
Jesus. And it's only getting worse. And I think that's a great question from the viewer. I think it's an excellent question.
And you know, we've been talking about the fuel from algae. And I just think, you know, we can sell this stuff. We can do it. You know,
Right.
I think I'm the only auto industry executive in history to take a complete crap on the oil industry. Remember when I did that? So the oil industry hates my guts. I said, BP is being treated incredibly unfairly. They said, we're going to pay for everything. And then the administration said, well, you're going to pay for everything. Yeah, we said we're going to pay for everything. Why are they having to drill in 5,000 feet of the ocean? Can you imagine trying to tap that? What they're doing is the near impossible. We had 7 tar balls coming towards Florida the other day from Louisiana from the spill. Ended up not being from them. They're doing everything they can. What they do is really risky work. Were there shortcuts? Probably, I don't know. This is high-tech stuff to do it. They're trying to do the best they can, and those are saying, let's don't drill at all. Okay, let's go on foreign oil for the rest of our lives. Well, I mean, this is crazy. Well, stop beating up business in America.
Well, look, I'm not for beating up business, but, you know, these guys have said all along, oh, we have no idea how much oil is coming out and we can't calculate it. Well, boom, boom, boom. A number of scientists came right out and said, here, we can easily calculate what this thing is. Today, BP came out and said, we think those guys might be right. And yet they're still trying to say we don't really know how much is coming out. I'm not sure I buy what you're saying. I think this is going to be a big disaster. It's coming out.
Where does most oil leaked into the oceans come from?
I don't know. Where?
Natural leaks of oil. This is a colossal disaster. It is. They're working like hell to try to fix it. They know this is such a stain on what they do, and it's going to cost them billions and billions of late. They have a lot of billions of dollars, but it costs them billions and billions of dollars. They don't want this to happen, and they're trying to fix it. But
oh,
you know, it's a needle in a haystack with what they're doing. It goes to the whole thing. Why don't we drill in Anwar in Alaska?
We don't have to drill.
We just kind of scratch the surface, and then it pops up like Jed Clampett.
Yeah, well, per the prior question, I think alternative fuels are going to get a whole lot more attention now.
Well, yeah, after being demonized as part of the
ethanol lobby. And they
were
demonized. I don't care what you come up with. Somebody's going to say, that's a terrible idea and we should not do it. But, hey, we got 2 more calls. Let's get them.
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan Brown in Old Japan.
All right.
I was wondering what you guys thought about Opel dragging GM down. Don't they have all the products that they need for the small and mid-sized market? I think it was important that GM keep Opel, but what's your opinion? Thank you.
They're trying to take out 20% capacity, 8,000 jobs. That's what's going on right now. They need to get that work done. They need to raise money to do it.
Yeah, Opel's problem is not a product problem. Opel's problem is an overcapacity problem. Too many plants, too many people. But in Europe, it's...
And an intransigent union.
And very intransigent union, more so than the UAW, and multiple unions, because you're talking about taking out capacity in Belgium and Germany, probably Spain as well, probably the UK. And until Opel downsizes, it'll never get profitable. But I'd fill in the blank for the rest of Europe's industry, too. Mm-hmm. Fiat has too much capacity. Volkswagen...
There's some interesting stuff in the Opel numbers in their earnings. Their market share is up a bit in Western Europe. They're doing really well in the UK. They're getting killed in Germany where all the politics and union stuff is going on. And it's this thing where, you know, these these people with the unions are stiff-arming them and making the cuts for all these years, and now they're angry with them. It's like they're shooting the golden goose if they don't get their way. And they want the jobs, whatever jobs they can keep or not. The company's not a charity.
Okay, one more call, and then we're going to wrap this up.
Hi, my name is Wes. Just calling to ask about what you guys think about the Mercury brand. Do you think it's going to stick around for a lot longer, or is it close to the end for Mercury? Because GM decided to keep Buick, is it competing with Buick, or is it just going to fizzle out? Anyway, thank you. Bye-bye.
Good question.
I think it's going to fizzle out.
Mercury will fizzle out?
It's been fizzling out. I was at Ford 2001, and we were talking about killing it then, when there were only 11 Mercury standalone dealers. And it just, it's like Monty Python, Holy Grail, I'm not dead yet. It just, they try to kill it, or thoughts of killing it, it stays alive, and they have an active marketing campaign, and they got the hot babe that sells the Mercury cars, and I've always said, since I was at Ford, kill Mercury and take that marketing money and development and really turn Lincoln into the premium American luxury brand. But for some reason, it just...
The reason I tell you exactly what it is all the Lincoln dealers saying, don't take Mercury away from me. I can't live on the volume of Lincoln alone. I need that Mercury volume.
Most of those guys are dual dealers. They got 2, 3, 4 dealers.
It's like that scene in The Spy Who Shagged Me. Why won't you die? It's got more lives than Saab.
I don't know. I thought there was a real opportunity to bring Ford of Europe products over and sell them only as Mercuries.
Except now Ford of Europe is mainstream Fords.
I know, yeah. I know.
And that was talked back in 2001.
Sure.
To bring the new Mondeo over and make it only a Mercury and so forth. It's just nobody has the intestinal fortitude to kill it. You're going to get a few lawsuits, a few.
Why don't they rebadge the Suzuki Esteem Wagon?
How much sway does the family have? I mean, because Elena Ford was involved in Mercury, and I remember her saying over her dead body, were they going to kill Mercury? Well, and I think the family carries a lot of sway at the company, and even an offhand remark can become policy.
I don't know. I wasn't there when that was said. Some very bright minds have said, we really are wasting money doing this, and I just don't get it.
Well, if anybody was going to be able to pull it off, it would have been Alan Mulally, who has the whole one Ford mantra, and it hasn't happened.
Well, maybe tomorrow he'll announce it. I'm killing, after watching Autoline After Hours, I'm killing Mercury.
I wouldn't give up on that discussion. It's probably going to unfold. You know, I need to comment on something that you forwarded an email to me about the new Fiesta campaign, and then the topic came up, which advertising is really good. You should check out the new Fiesta campaign. It's very clever, very different, very unexpected from a major manufacturer, especially an American manufacturer. So it's the tag, the working theme line is, it's a pretty big deal. And the way they unfold it, it's very clever.
And they're going to have Joe Biden as a spokesperson saying it's a pretty big effing deal.
That would have been good. Have him pop up in the field.
Well, look, we're past our normal time here, so we're going to wrap it up. But Peter, David, Jason, great having all of us here together again every Thursday. This is really good.
Thanks, John.
Remember, all of you out there, you can always follow us at Facebook, facebook.com/Autoline Detroit, twitter.com/Autoline. Go to autoextremist.com, like religion every week, or you can follow Peter, too, at twitter.com/Autoextremist. Check out David's work at businessweek.com. Because that's still or is it Bloomberg Businessweek.com?
Businessweek.com, and then there's a Bloomberg.com website.
Okay. Go there, too. And, Jason, here's your chance to pitch
Thank
Forgotten
you.
Harvest.
I have heard from a lot of folks that have heard about Forgotten Harvest on the show. Again, terrible times in Metro Detroit for hungry people. Forgotten Harvest is doing really great. We've gone from 13 million meals last year. We're going to deliver 18 million meals this year. We need your support. Every dollar you give provides five meals for hungry people throughout Metro Detroit.
18 million.
That's a lot of meals.
Every hour provides five meals.
So,
and you should explain too how Forgotten Harvest gets so much of its food to feed these needy people.
We have 25 trucks now, I believe. It's ForgottenHarvest.org. ForgottenHarvest.org. We have 25 trucks, refrigerated trucks, supplied by Daimler Chrysler, Chrysler Financial Services, Daimler Financial Services, General Motors, CompuWare, Ford Motor Company has really come in a big way lately. They go out to the Kroger's, to the Nino Salvaggio's, to the wholesalers,
supermarkets,
restaurants, gather up fresh food that's really good, meats, dairy.
That's otherwise going to be thrown away.
It's going to be thrown away, but it's still really good. And we immediately turn those trucks around when the trucks are full and go to the soup kitchens, churches, homeless shelters, and we drop that food off and then give it to people that may be their only meal of the day. For some, it's their only meal in a few days. And 18 million meals.
18 million is just
so, and the need is so great. Every dollar you can give online. Every dollar feeds five people. Think about it. A $10 donation gives you 50 people. I got to give kudos to Elon Musk of Tesla. Gave us $30,000 from an auction of a S Roadster.
Wow.
And to some other charities. And at the event at the DAC a couple weeks ago, I mentioned to him in thanking him for this money that he just fed 180,000 people. And on the spot, he doubled the donation personally.
Wow.
So whatever you can do, it's a shame that people are neighbors anywhere. If you're not in Detroit, there are food banks in your community.
Help them out.
Help them out. Just call information for a food bank, a soup kitchen. There's one everywhere. And make a donation. The money goes a long way.
And you don't have to give a lot, as you say.
You don't have to volunteer. Most of the food banks need your money. Because they need to purchase food or gather food.
Real good. Well,
thank you for letting me do that.
Yeah, no, you bet. Good way to wrap up the show. Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.